I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and there's been a flurry of headlines regarding U.S. intelligence. The revelation that the Jordanian suicide bomber who killed seven CIA agents in Afghanistan was a double agent working for both the CIA and terrorists. The just-released report that excoriates intelligence in Afghanistan, saying agents were more interested in the enemy than in insight from locals, and that policymakers got more information from local newspapers. And, of course, President Obama's sit-down today with top government officials to hear about failures regarding the alleged Christmas plane bomber. Shivam Gorman is intelligence correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Shivam, the suicide bombing at that CIA base in Afghanistan, the bomber, Jordanian Dr. al-Balawi, was hired by the CIA to infiltrate al-Qaeda in the hope that he would lead them to al-Qaeda's number two. First of all, that wasn't that unusual, was it, that the CIA would have that relationship with the Jordanian?
Well, it wasn't unusual that the U.S. would have that kind of relationship with the Jordanian Intelligence Service, and the Jordanian Intelligence Service appears to be the group that was facilitating the meeting with this informant. And we sort of, in terms of gathering the facts and reading between the lines a little bit because we're still gathering facts, it sounds like the Jordanian Intelligence Service had recruited this informant, and the informant had been working with both the U.S. and Jordanian intelligence officials for at least some period of time. It's not clear quite how long prior to this particular meeting last week.
But they are saying it wasn't known that he was actually working for potentially militants. And yet we're hearing that he was detained for a few months by Jordanian intelligence officers. This was before he became, you know, someone who worked with the CIA. Shouldn't that have raised a flag? Why was he detained?
Well, he was detained because of activities that appeared to be in concert with al-Qaeda and terrorism more broadly. And so that obviously would raise red flags, but my understanding is that the Jordanian Intelligence Service felt that over time they had actually flipped him to the U.S. and Jordanian side, and so that's why they thought they could trust him.
Well, and he continued to be an active recruiter, as you describe it, online. He someone trying to reach disaffected Americans, in particular, on a password protected al-Qaeda website. So as he did that while he was supposedly working for the U.S. And Jordan, did U.S. and Jordanian agents just think that that was his cover?
Well, we don't know that at this point, and that's obviously something that everybody is looking into and trying to understand a little bit better, because there do certainly seem to have been some very overt and public signs that this particular individual had a lot of sympathies with al-Qaeda. But again, we don't know what the specific interactions were with the U.S. and Jordanian intelligence service, and it could be that he told a very good story.
Yeah. Are questions also being raised about why so many CIA agents were in one place in Afghanistan? Many of them we're hearing now usually sat at desks in Washington, including the foremost authority in the U.S. on bin Laden, a woman who was killed. What were they doing, all of them in one, you know, cluster on essentially the front lines?
Well, the CIA, since 9/11 in particular, has really been pushing a lot of people out to the front lines. And we don't know a lot about the base chief, but we do know that she had served in the CIA's bin Laden unit, which may mean that she her background was really as an analyst. But the CIA has also been, what they say, forward deploying even analysts to the front lines to provide expertise. And the CIA has set up a number of these bases around Afghanistan in order to sort of get closer to the ground and try to better understand what the dynamics are there on the ground. And so that's been a post 9/11 evolution for the CIA.
Well, and we've been hearing for 10 years that this was the problem prior to 9/11, that there weren't enough agents who could speak the language, who could infiltrate, who could understand the people, that there weren't enough, you know, intelligence boots on the ground, especially in Afghanistan. And so it feels in one way as if the CIA was doing exactly what it was told to do post 9/11.
Well, yes. I mean, there's no question that the activities of these CIA officers in Khost were exactly what we've been asking them to do. I mean, they had been primarily asked to gather information on some very violent militant networks that exist in the area, the Haqqani network, and they were also working on gathering information on al-Qaeda just over the border in Pakistan. So that they were running informants, they were doing classic spy work, and so there wasn't anything even all that unusual about what they were doing there.
Well, and there have always been double agents. And I'm just wondering, are you hearing, you know, maybe a broader discussion from the intelligence community about how, you know, there's always been this problem, except now what may be different is the ideological aspect of the enemy, that, you know, when you inject religion into this, maybe they're confronting something new and different than, let's say, they saw in the Soviet Union.
Well, they're certainly confronting something different from what they saw with the Soviet Union, but the problem is essentially the same, which is if somebody has previously been working with the other team, how can you be sure that they're now on your team? And that is something that the agency is going to continue to struggle with, and obviously after these events, they're taking a look at, you know, the vetting process and security procedures and all those kinds of things, and there is already a pretty hefty debate, particularly among you know, intelligence professionals and former CIA officials who have worked in that area over what exactly the proper way is to handle informants.
Al-Balawi gave an interview to an Islamist magazine in which he said, "I've had a predisposition for love of jihad and martyrdom since I was little. If it answers a man's heart, it's not going to leave him." And the New York Times writes that presumably his U.S. handlers knew about that interview but thought, again, it was part of his cover. Well, meanwhile, this all feeds into the new report on intelligence in Afghanistan written by two military officers from the Center for a New American Security. One operations officer quoted in the report says, "I don't want to say we're clueless, but we are. It really just excoriates intelligence in Afghanistan."
It does. It says that basically U.S. intelligence is only marginally relevant to the Afghan strategy right now. And obviously it's pushing for U.S. intelligence to become much more relevant. And what this report points to is actually a debate that's been going on for some years now, which is how much of the intelligence effort should focus on our enemies versus how much of our intelligence effort should focus on who our friends are or who our potential friends are in the region.
Oh, and Siobhan, one last question. It's been a rough week. A rough couple of weeks for the intelligence community. What are you hearing from them?
Well, it's been a really difficult week, particularly at the CIA. I mean, last week President Obama came out and he said that there were major intelligence failures related to this Christmas Day bombing, and the CIA was one of the agencies that was implicated in that. And then shortly after that, they had the bombing of their base, which was obviously a direct hit. And so I know that folks over there are just reeling right now.
Siobhan Gorman, intelligence correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
In most American inner cities, it's easier to get Cheetos than an apple or green beans. That's one reason why, by the age of 3, more than a third of low-income urban kids are already overweight. And a recent Philadelphia study showed that kids walking to and from school spent an average of $1 a day on 400 calories worth of candy and chips at convenience stores. But produce is expensive for small markets to handle. It spoils, and it's often hard to find urban space for the big chain supermarkets, which also shy away from neighborhoods that can't afford the expensive prepared foods or fancy breads that help them make their bottom line. So some cities are rising to that challenge. In Newark, New York, Cleveland, Portland, Oregon, there are now programs to entice large supermarkets into the inner city with grants and loans and to help out the corner markets already there with incentives like free refrigeration units. Pennsylvania started the Pennsylvania Fresh Food Financing Initiative 5 years ago. It's helped people like Juan Carlos Romano, who owns Romano's Grocery in the Juniata Park section of North Philadelphia. They sell sandwiches and some prepared foods. But Juan Carlos, before this initiative gave you a grant to renovate your store, how much produce did you carry?
The only thing that I had in my store was onions, lettuce, and tomato because we use it to make our sandwiches with.
Yeah. Well, and then last year you received a $150,000 grant from this Pennsylvania program to pay the cost of installing new lighting and energy-efficient refrigeration. So first of all, describe what did you get there?
I got a completely new store. We bought new equipment, new refrigeration, where they consume 40% less energy than any other conventional fridge. We got new lighting. They also consume less energy. Now we can offer the community fresh produce and vegetables.
What kind of things are you carrying now?
Well, now we have lettuce, we have tomato, we have potatoes, we have onions, we have banana, we have plantain, avocado, red pepper, apples, grape, celery, lime, mangoes, and everything else that is in season.
And are people buying them?
Oh, of course, yes. At the beginning, it was a little bit hard, but people got used to it, and then people is happy about it because there's a lot of people that don't have the transportation to get to a big supermarket where they can find good fresh produce. It's more convenient for them to just come and buy it with us. And also it's helping the store out because our business has increased like 35% more than what we was doing before.
Wow. After a slow start in the beginning. Well, you know, Juan Carlos, it reminds us, though, the fact that supermarkets don't come into the inner city is a huge part of this problem as well, although the Pennsylvania Fresh Food Financing Initiative is helping supermarkets come in as well, giving them some incentives and subsidies so that at least one has come into the Parkside area. But outside of that, there's a whole generation of kids who, when they go to the corner store, have only been able to grab, you know, cookies or Cheetos, like we said. Are you seeing kids change their eating habits?
Yes, yes, of course. There's a lot of kids that instead of they grabbing chips or anything, there's some of them that they do come and they grab apple. A lot of the kids, they like grapes. So for us, we feel very, very happy when we see these kind of things that are happening.
We understand that you have plans to now have a produce stand outside when it warms up a little bit. What will that do? What happens on the sidewalk when you can put produce out?
Well, the street where we are is very, very busy. So anybody who goes by, they're not really seeing what we have. So it's going to be more appealing when they can see what they could get.
Well, what would you say then to store owners who might be concerned about this switch? Because, you know, it's easier to put out bags of cookies. There's not as much maintenance. With fruit, there's spoilage, there's meeting deliveries. You've got to work a little bit harder, and some stores might not be willing to take that chance. What would you say to them?
Well, what I say to them is, you know, you have to use your conscience. If we want to end obesity, and I think we should be all conscious and everybody put a little bit of sand in the bag, and then we can actually help our community because they actually support us. So I think there's a way that we can support them too by helping them to eat fresh produce and vegetables and keep their lives healthier.
Well, it's admirable, and but I'm wondering, would you be willing to go as far as some cities are, Hartford, Connecticut, and in Cleveland? They're actually asking store owners to replace their junk food and soft drinks with groceries. In other words, take some of the candy and cookies off the counter and replace them with baskets of fruit. And in return, they're supplying the store owners with research about what people are buying. But, you know, are you actually replacing some of your junk food? Are you ready to take that risk?
Well, the customer, they choose what they want. If you don't have what they want, they will eventually go to another place. In my case, I know all the people around my neighborhood, and they kind of listen to me. So, you know, I let them know, like, instead of you choosing this, why don't you just grab a banana or something more healthier?
Juan Carlos Romano of Romano's Grocery in the Juniata Park section of North Philadelphia, who's put more fresh food and produce in his store as a result of a Pennsylvania program that helped him buy the refrigeration. Juan Carlos, thanks so much.
You're welcome. The pleasure's mine.
Back with more, getting veggies into the inner city, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We've been hearing about programs to get fresh produce into inner city stores. We just spoke with Juan Carlos Romano, who owns Romano's Grocery there in Philadelphia. The Pennsylvania program, the Fresh Food Financing Initiative, helped him finance an expansion of his small store and build new refrigeration units so he could carry more produce. Now he sells celery, peppers, apples. James Johnson Hyatt was involved in that Pennsylvania program. He now consults on similar initiatives in Detroit and Newark. He owns a company called Urbane Development. James, the Pennsylvania initiative also gives grants to get bigger chain stores into low-income areas. For instance, a ShopRite that opened up in the Parkside neighborhood of West Philadelphia in 2008. Now, they also took out loans, but why would a chain like ShopRite need a grant from the state of Pennsylvania to open up in an inner-city area?
Well, there's a couple of different reasons. The cost of doing business in urban areas in general, and particularly in lower-income communities where traditional market assessments deem certain places not as lucrative as others, it's harder to entice retailers to set up shop there. The cost of labor is more expensive. Soft costs like security, the cost to acquire land is significant. In this case, you had to assemble over 100 different parcels to create the land space needed to build out the actual store.
Yeah, people are very critical of supermarket chains for abandoning the inner cities, but they do have a higher cost in the inner city. For instance, people of lower income don't buy those high-priced items that people in the suburbs might, the prepared foods, fancy breads and things like that, that really put supermarkets over the top. And in some more diverse neighborhoods, they have food needs that some supermarkets really can't afford to cater to. But I understand this ShopRite, with the help of the state, has food for Jamaican cuisine, has a halal meat counter set up for the many Muslims who live in the neighborhood. They can afford to have the kinds of foods that the people who live there want.
Yeah, I think the owner of ShopRite and the structure of ShopRite in and of itself lends itself to doing more dynamic, diverse sourcing of products. ShopRite is actually a cooperative. The way it's structured is, you know, each individual owner can own one ShopRite, can own 20 ShopRites. But collectively, the owners of the different ShopRites across the country own their distribution collectively. So they're able to aggregate the amount of buying power together at the wholesale level, but operate independently like an independent grocer would. So Jeff Brown, the owner of the ShopRite that you're speaking about in West Philadelphia, can be very flexible about their purchasing and can really dig down deep into their own demographics to figure out, well, this is how I merchandise, this is how I source for my particular clientele. You know, a similar chain of size and scope where the buying decisions occur in Montana or they occur in Minnesota, they have a much more difficult time being able to get to that level of specificity for those stores.
What do people in the neighborhood say about, you know, having a ShopRite they can walk to?
The folks that are in close proximity to that store, I mean, absolutely adore it because they're getting the same level of quality in terms of the grocery store experience that they would get in a suburb.
Well, but can you, it's only been there a year and the small markets have had their refrigeration, you know, for only a little while as well. And we just heard from Juan Carlos that more fruit is being sold. But is there any way to measure whether that's having an impact on people's health?
Right. I mean, I think something's being built in the last year, the last 2 years, you can really only speak anecdotally. But I do feel like when you place more access points for a fresh product, you know, those sales speak to a level of consumption that's clearly going to change someone's diet when they didn't have that same option.
James Johnson Pyatt, a consultant. His company's called Urbane Development. And we've been talking about Philadelphia, James, but I know you also consult in Newark and Detroit. And just your thoughts on what some other cities are trying to do in some cities, sort of striking deals with small store owners to ask them to move some of the candy away from the register and replace it with fruit. Or in New York, they're allowing people to build huge apartment complexes if they promise to put a supermarket on the first floor. Some of the deals that cities are striking because they know they have to get fresh food into neighborhoods.
Yeah, I mean, what's happening right now is you got an incredibly dynamic nexus of issues of health, issues of land use, issues of economic development, and issues of quality of life. And cities are recognizing that all these things are, you know, playing a part in attracting the types of employees and employers and residents and citizens that they want to bring into their cities. The work that I'm doing right now in Newark is pretty innovative because it's the first time you've had an economic development agency really take a comprehensive look at the fresh food issue. The Newark program is called the Fresh Foods Initiative, and they basically split food into three separate sections. One is promoting farmers markets in Newark. The second piece is a supermarket program similar to the ones in Pennsylvania where they have some loans and grants available for supermarket development. And, you know, the program that I'm working more in detail with is a small grocery program where we're focusing on, you know, refrigeration, lighting, basically all the mechanical things that need to happen in order to really make, you know, stores thrive and be able to sell fresh food products. And then we're going to add technical assistance, providing the entrepreneur an opportunity to talk to people with skills who've done it before, working with them on, you know, the inventory management, the accounting, the bookkeeping, the product handling and the product sourcing, really creating a robust program that's not simply, you know, again, providing just dollars and cents, but helping entrepreneurs, you know, stabilize their business platform as well. And in Detroit, we're doing this at a much bigger scale. It's a pretty comprehensive program running out of the city's economic development agency. You know, so there's definitely a lot of different programs going on. And in terms of smaller stores, there's literally hundreds of new products that are sprouting up in areas from California to in Boston is a program that's being vetted right now for our corner store development. So it's happening all over the country right now. I think it's hitting a tipping point. And so, you know, people are really excited about, you know, the possibility of really seeing positive, tangible change in these smaller stores.
That's James Johnson Pyatt. His company's called Urbane Development. He's been working with cities to try to bring more fresh fruit and produce to corner stores and thereby to the people who live near them. James, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Oh, no problem.
Okay, taking a look ahead, tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll speak with National Book Award winner Ha Jin, who's turned his attention from life in China to life for Chinese immigrants here in the U.S. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, music from Dave Rawlings, and also a claim from Libya that they have converted Al-Qaeda sympathizers. They say they may be able to teach the U.S. something. Is it real? We'll take a look at that story ahead as well after the latest news here and now. Much of the country is paralyzed today with record-breaking snowfalls and bitterly cold temperatures. 4 feet of snow in Syracuse, New York. 4 deaths blamed on the cold in Tennessee. And forecasters are saying that chill in the South will last the rest of the week. It's 19 degrees in northwest Alabama. Here's Mark Kelly with the Birmingham, Alabama Emergency Management Agency.
We're looking at the longest extended stretch of bitterly cold weather, particularly in the evenings, that we've had in probably a quarter century.
Mississippi and the Florida Panhandle have temperatures in the 20s. Farmers there trying to save strawberry and tomato crops. Heavy snows and frigid temperatures have also closed schools in Arkansas, Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and North Carolina. Wisconsin is used to difficult winters, but this year there's a hitch. Wisconsin has gone green, and sometimes you can't see the green or the red or yellow, for that matter. Many traffic departments have been replacing old-fashioned incandescent traffic lights with new light-emitting diodes, or LEDs, which are environmentally cool. They use less energy. They last longer. They're usually more visible. But the problem is they really are cool. They don't emit much heat, and so they've been getting covered by snow and ice, and that's caused dozens of accidents and at least one death in the past year. Joanna Bush is a traffic signal systems engineer for the Department of Transportation in Wisconsin, which has converted more than 90% of its traffic lights to LEDs. Joanna, are you seeing accidents because of that?
Well, Robin, we've heard a lot about crashes that have happened as a result of this, but we haven't had a chance to actually pull the statistics. But we definitely hear a lot through our state patrol and other sources that these are occurring.
So what are you doing about it?
Here in Wisconsin, we're actually doing a couple of things. One is that when we are notified by state patrol or a concerned citizen of a snow-covered head, we dispatch our electricians to clean the heads off. But in a more proactive way, we're currently trying out some new technology. We have procured some what they're calling snow shields, which are supposed to prevent the snow from accumulating and covering the head.
You know, it makes this sort of the eye of the traffic light look like it has a little lid on it.
That's correct.
Right, right. Well, so brushing off lights, you know, sending workers out to brush off lights, trying to get new technology. Are you also maybe thinking of changing back, or is Wisconsin seeing enough savings from the LEDs that you think it's worth staying with them?
Well, while we are seeing savings, they figure about $750,000 a year. This isn't unique to LEDs. We actually had a similar problem with our incandescent bulbs.
Huh.
Even though they burn hot, and that's where they lose a lot of their energy, some of the lenses, for example, the yellow, are only on for about 4 seconds every 60 seconds, and that's not enough time to really generate any heat to burn off the snow.
Huh.
So depending on your snowy event, our incandescent bulbs would also get snow covered.
So bottom line, is there sort of a common sense here thing maybe for people to think about when they approach an intersection?
Absolutely. We like to remind our drivers that when you're driving in these types of snow conditions where it's a heavy, wet snow with lots of wind, if you can't see the signal indication, treat it as a dark signal.
Yeah.
Slow down, stop, and look at the traffic around you, because the other directions of traffic, their heads are probably not covered. And so you need to look and respond according to how they're behaving, because they're not going to know that your signal has been covered with snow.
Because the wind usually comes in one direction.
That's correct.
Joanna Bush, traffic signal systems engineer for the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. Joanna, thanks.
Thank you so much, Robin.
This quick note, you can add Fox News panelist Britt Hume to the roster of people with advice for Tiger Woods. But Hume, a former news anchor, speaking on Fox News Sunday, may be the first to recommend that Tiger switch religions.
The extent to which he can recover, it seems to me, depends on his faith. He's said to be a Buddhist. I don't think that faith offers the kind of forgiveness and redemption that is offered by the Christian faith. So my message to Tiger would be, Tiger, turn your faith, turn to the Christian faith, and you can make a total recovery and be a great example to the world.
His comments seem to confound the Fox News panel. The blogosphere has lit up with opinions ranging from Hume has the right to express his opinion on faith to he has no right to use the news pulpit to evangelize to what is he saying? Christianity offers a better deal? To he's wrong about Buddhism. Well, let's give Buddhists the last word. Blogger Barbara O'Brien writes that the practice of metta, loving kindness, is essential in Buddhism, and she says, metta is extended to all beings, including those who have wronged us, even Brit Hume. We'll be back in a minute with Libya's claims of fighting terrorism. That's actually in 30 seconds, here and now. Libya has been traveling a rocky road to reconciliation with the West, which long considered the country a state sponsor of terrorism. After 9/11, Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi offered himself to the U.S. to fight al-Qaeda, and in 2004, Libya dismantled its nuclear program. But then last year, Libyans gave a heroic welcome home to the Lockerbie bomber after he was released from a Scottish prison. Well, now another twist and turn. Libya is claiming that it's persuaded a violent Islamic group to renounce al-Qaeda. The group is called the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, and members trained and fought with Osama bin Laden in the late 90s in Afghanistan and Sudan. Many were then captured and imprisoned by Libya. Could the U.S. learn something about fighting al-Qaeda now from Gaddafi? Borzu Daragahi of the Los Angeles Times met with members of the group recently in Libya. Borzu, Gaddafi's son, headed the team that worked to turn this group away from violence. What did they do?
They reached out to the leadership of this group, exiled some of them in London, and met with them and talked with them and said, look, let's make a deal. And part of that deal was opening up Libya's political environment a little bit, giving space to these Islamists to pursue their activities through proper legal channels, and giving them some hope that, and this was done in a very subtle way, that after the senior Gaddafi, Muammar, passes on, that there will be a more open political environment for them to operate.
Well, and then some cynics might say that part of that deal was sort of like a get-out-of-jail card, because some of them, as we said, had been imprisoned. And so did you get a sense that they were maybe just saying what Muammar Gaddafi and his son wanted to hear in order to get out of jail?
Well, I think that there is an element to that. But the way these guys were talking, the way these Islamist fighters were talking, was that they were convinced that the direction that Libya was going towards was one that they could handle. I think also there's a generational thing here. You know, these guys, when they joined the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, when they went to Afghanistan, when they fought alongside Osama bin Laden, when they traipsed around the Middle East, meeting with each other and living this kind of covert existence, they were in their 20s, late teens sometimes. And then when they turned into their 30s, maybe they just got a little tired of that life. And that was something that struck me, is like, you know, they wanted families and normal lives and had just somewhat matured a little bit in their worldviews.
Well, and as you say, they also were horrified, not just by the war in Iraq and that escalation, but the attacks of September 11th and just the violence against civilians in general.
Exactly. They had not, this particular group at least, had not signed on to the kind of attacks on civilians that were practiced by the next generation of al-Qaeda fighters, especially those in Iraq and in Afghanistan and so on, where civilians were targeted.
Do you get a sense that these men will be helpful in now giving intelligence on Osama bin Laden?
Well, I think they've already been helpful in terms of giving intelligence on Osama bin Laden. They had, you know, some of them had details about meetings with Osama bin Laden that they were sharing with me that I thought were kind of interesting. Like one was talking about going to Ramadan dinners with Osama bin Laden in the Sudan, and he was talking about it in extraordinary detail and what kind of guy Osama bin Laden was and so on. And I'm sure that they've been giving a lot more tantalizing details about Osama bin Laden, his method, the way of thinking, the history, filling in chapters of the guy's life to the Libyan authorities. Whether the Libyans are sharing those with the U.S., I'm not certain. I'm sure they're sharing that information with other European countries that they're close to, such as Italy. One thing that's kind of interesting is that these Islamists were saying that when they would meet with their interrogators after they'd been arrested, and inevitably many of them were arrested, picked up in other countries, and extradited to Libya, their interrogators would open the meetings by giving them their whole life story in amazing detail that stunned them, so that these Libyan intelligence officers knew more about their lives than they did, as one put it, and had been following them from the very beginning, had been following them when they went to Afghanistan and, you know, Saudi Arabia and Yemen. Their whole trajectory had been tracked by the Libyan authorities. And I thought that was really interesting, that this sort of intelligence was a very important tool in getting these guys not only captured, but in convincing them that there's no point in trying to become this swashbuckling undercover terrorist operative.
Well, again, we're reminded of Saudi Arabia, which runs a rehab program for terrorists and claims a lot of success. But we now know that during the Bush administration, two Guantanamo detainees were sent to that program, and they ultimately ended up as al-Qaeda operatives in neighboring Yemen. So some might be skeptical of what Libya is claiming as success, but these former militants you spoke to wrote a 400-page paper called Revised Studies, and it's been read by analysts at West Point. What do they say about it?
Well, I think people have been impressed by the theoretical underpinnings of this book, in which they go through Islamic teachings and they come to the conclusion that violence is not supported by the Quran as a way of achieving political goals, and that they were on the wrong path in terms of pursuing violence. And they go through and they identify the mistakes they'd made. The experts I talked to said that the most significant thing about this particular action on the part of the Libyans was not just that they had converted individual al-Qaeda members, as Saudi and Yemen have claimed to have done, but that they got a whole group to jump ship and then publicly denounce al-Qaeda. In that sense, this was a little bit different than those other programs.
But what's your sense, Borzu, having spoken to many of these people? Is this something that only other Islamists can do? Or is this something that the U.S. and other Western nations can learn from?
I think you're right on both counts. I think it's something that the U.S. And Western nations can learn from, that some of these political groups, at least, are not just nihilists hell-bent on destruction, but they have actual political goals, however misguided their methods and even their goals may be, and that there might be ways of reforming political systems and political situations so that they give up violence and try to pursue their goals in a political way. You know, I'm in Lebanon, and you see a similar thing here where the main Sunni politician has reached out to the most extreme Sunni Islamists, trying to get them and convince them that the best way to achieve their goals is through the electoral process. Whether that would work in a place like, you know, Pakistan, if the U.S. were to reach out to the Taliban, not clear.
Borzu Daragahi of the Los Angeles Times speaking to us from Lebanon about his recent trip to Libya to see firsthand what Libya claims is success in convincing a militant group with ties to Osama bin Laden to renounce al-Qaeda. Borzu, thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Okay, just a quick reminder here. You can always listen to our show stream live at our website, hereandnow.org. You can search the archives. You can download a podcast. You can say hello. Just hit contact us. And you can also follow us on Twitter at Here and Now. When we come back, out of Gillian Welch's shadow, Here and Now. Welcome back. Musician Dave Rawlings is better known as Gillian Welch's other half. They're a couple musically and romantically. You can hear Dave's beautiful harmonies and guitar supporting Gillian on songs like Caleb Meyer. But now Dave Rawlings is stepping out of that backup role, and Gillian Welch is supporting him on his first solo CD. It's called A Friend of a Friend. Rolling Stone gives it a 4-star review.
I hear the crying of the hungry in the deserts where they're wandering. Hear them crying out for heaven's own benevolence upon them. Hear destructive power prevailing. I hear fools falsely hailing to the crooked wits of tyrants when they call. I hear them all, I hear them all, I hear them all.
And Dave Rawlings joins us from the studios of WPLN in Nashville, Tennessee. Boy, 4 stars in Rolling Stone, that's pretty good.
Actually, I was pleasantly surprised that they even reviewed it at all.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, when we were working on this project, we'd started working a little bit on Gillian's new record. We knew we had written a few songs recently and had some other stuff from the past that we thought would maybe make a record for me, but we were pretty unsure about whether we should go ahead with it.
And I understand it was you. You know, you weren't sure you wanted to do the solo thing. Why was that, and what changed your mind?
I just didn't know that I was going to be able to hear something that came out of speakers that I was comfortable with or that I felt that people would enjoy. And I also, because it's been a long time since Gillian made a record, I didn't want to delay that. I didn't want to try to make a record and then decide that we didn't think we were happy with it and then have, you know, sort of set us back some. So I don't know. That's a good answer, but it's sort of the truth.
There you are. Well, there are some covers on the CD. Let's listen to one of those. The Monkey and the Engineer, an old country blues by Jesse Fuller.
Once upon a time, there was an engineer. He drove a locomotive both far and near. Accompanied by a monkey who would sit on a stool, watching everything the engineer would do. One day the engineer wanted a bite to eat. He left the monkey sitting on the driver's seat. The monkey pulled the throttle, locomotive jumped the gun, and did 90 miles an hour down the mainline run. The big locomotive's right on time.
And then there's another cover we want to hear, and especially since when I asked you why you were reticent to, you know, be the lead, I'd read that you said at one point that you thought your voice was kind of reedy maybe and thin and, you know.
Yeah, I feel as though my voice is, I mean, it's not a classically great sounding voice. I mean, what I try to remember is that my favorite music in the world is from other people with not classically perfect voices, so.
Well, that brings us to another guy with, you know, a thin voice who's done quite well. You do a cover of Neil Young's Cortez the Killer. Let's listen.
Came dancing across the water with his galleons and guns, looking for the new world and the palace in the sun.
So again, Dave Rawlings, Neil Young, has some would say a kind of a thinnish voice, but powerful stories. What is it about that song?
You know, I have a very specific recollection of sort of, you know, lying on the floor at a friend's house, you know, when I was young, listening to that track and just being so intrigued by the pacing of it and the great long instrumental before there was any vocal. There's just the space on that track, I think, greatly influenced maybe the way I play guitar or the music that I love.
Well, then you wrote seven of the songs on the CD. You write about a woman whose affections are remote. That's in Ruby. The narrator in one of your songs, you know, is happy with the simple indulgences in life. He doesn't understand why people want more. It's too easy. You take one out of the, you know, out of the playbook of songs. You write about the lost and lonely, the left behind, I hear them all. And the bittersweet lure of addiction. Let's listen to a little of Sweet Tooth.
Sweet tooth, crying shame. The sweet tooth, crying shame. Sweet tooth, crying shame. Gotta feed the sweet tooth 10 times a day just to hear the wind blowing on a windy day. Cairo, it's a mean old town. Cairo, it's a mean old town. Cairo, mean old town. That's what my Uncle John told me when the sweet tooth got him down.
It's Dave Rawlings, backed up by Gillian Welch on his song Sweet Tooth. We hear the gorgeous way your voices blend. It's like out of some Woody Guthrie recording or something. But also this topic, how'd that come to you?
There's so many little stories that run through different songs, you know, that I've written or that I've written with Gillian. Things that just pop up in verses, and it's nice because when you sing, you remember them. That Uncle John... That goes back to a conversation that we had one time with John Hartford out at his place. when we had been touring, and we'd stopped in Cairo by the river and been walking around through a very sort of depressed little area of Cairo where there were just warehouses and drifters, and it was really a frightening little afternoon. And we told John that, and he's like, "What are you doing in Cairo?" It's like, "That's a mean old town." But then Cairo being also referring to Cairo syrup, and also there's a town in Georgia where I think they make Cairo syrup called Cairo. So it all gets in there.
And where was the Cairo he spoke of? Is that Cairo,
yeah,
southern
sure
Illinois?
It's Illinois. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's where the rivers come together there.
We want to close with another song that you wrote, Dave Rawlings. It's called Bells of Harlem. It's also just gorgeous. Let's listen.
Far down the streets, I see the sign. The crowd is breathing faster. Some must have walked 100 blocks. I see the flocks and pastures. Oh, what a time to be alive. Tears of the past forgotten. It's been a long and lonely night. I hear the bells of
Very reflective. What did you bring to that song?
You know, there was a feeling that I had one time of being in a crowd, you know, in Manhattan, that informed the verse about seeing the flocks and pastures and seeing people all gathered together for one purpose. That memory found its way into the song.
That's Dave Rawlings. The CD is called A Friend of a Friend, with backups from his friend, Vivian Welch. Dave, thanks so much for speaking to us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
We ground it down to sorghum. You couldn't stop the freedom train. I hear the bells of
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.